to feel one knows things a bit deeper is to try to go into them a bit deeper. The sea gets deeper as you go further into it, according to a Venetian proverb. Curiosity is anti-fragile, like an addiction, and is magnified by attempts to satisfy it. Books have a secret mission and ability to multiply, as everyone who has wall-to-wall bookshelves knows well. Nero lived, at the time of writing, among 15,000 books, with the stress of how to discard the empty boxes and wrapping material after the arrival of his daily shipment from the bookstore. One subject Nero read for pleasure, rather than the strange duty to read to become more learned, was medical texts, for which he had a natural curiosity. The curiosity came from having had two brushes with death, the first from a cancer and the second from a helicopter crash that alerted him to both the fragility of technology and the self-healing powers of the human body. So he spent a bit of his time reading textbooks, not papers, textbooks, in medicine, or professional texts. Nero's formal training was in statistics and probability, which he approached as a special branch of philosophy. He had been spending all his adult life writing a philosophical technical book called Probability and Metaprobability. His tendency was to abandon the project every 2 years and take it up again 2 years later. He felt that the concept of probability as used was too narrow and incomplete to express the true nature of decisions in the ecology of the real world. Nero enjoyed taking long walks in old cities without a map. He used the following method to detouristify his traveling. He tried to inject some randomness into his schedule by never deciding on the next destination until he had spent some time in the first one, driving his travel agent crazy. When he was in Zagreb, his next destination would be determined by his state of mind while in Zagreb. Largely, it was the smell of places that drew him to them. Smell cannot be conveyed in a catalog. Mostly, when in New York, Nero sat in his study with his writing desk set against the window, occasionally looking dreamily at the New Jersey shore across the Hudson River and reminding himself how happy he was to not live there. So he conveyed to Fat Tony that the "I have no use for you" was reciprocal, in equally non-diplomatic terms, which, as we will see, was not true. On Suckers and Non-Suckers. After the crisis of 2008, it became clear what the two fellows had in common. They were predicting a sucker's fragility crisis. What had gotten them together was that they had both been convinced that a crisis of such magnitude, with a snowballing destruction of the modern economic system in a way and on a scale never seen before, was bound to happen, simply because they were suckers. But our two characters came from two entirely different schools of thought. Fat Tony believed that nerds, administrators, and mostly bankers were the ultimate suckers. That was when everyone still thought they were geniuses. And, what's more, he believed that collectively they were even bigger suckers than they were individually. And he had a natural ability to detect these suckers before they fell apart. Fat Tony derived his income from that activity while leading, as we saw, a life of leisure. Nero's interests were similar to Tony's, except dressed up in intellectual traditions. To Nero, a system built on illusions of understanding probability is bound to collapse. By betting against fragility, they were anti-fragile. So Tony made a bundle from the crisis, in the high 8 to low 9 figures. Everything other than a bundle for Tony is talk. Nero made a bit, though much less than Tony, but he was satisfied that he had won. As we said, he had already been financially independent, and he saw money as a waste of time. To put it bluntly, Nero's family's wealth had peaked in 1804, so he did not have the social insecurity of other adventurers, and money to him could not possibly be a social statement, only erudition for now, and perhaps wisdom in old age. Excess wealth, if you don't need it, is a heavy burden. Nothing was more hideous in his eyes than excessive refinement in clothes, food, lifestyle, manners, and wealth was non-linear. Beyond some level, it forces people into endless complications of their lives, creating worries about whether the housekeeper in one of the country houses is scamming them while doing a poor job, and similar headaches that multiply with money. The ethics of betting against suckers will be discussed in Book 7, but there are two schools of thought. To Nero, one should first warn people that they are suckers, while Tony was against the very notion of warning. "You will be ridiculed," he said. "Words are for sissies." A system based on verbal warnings will be dominated by non-risk-taking babblers. These people won't give you and your ideas respect unless you take their money. Further, Fat Tony insisted that Nero take a ritual look at the physical embodiments of the spoils, such as a bank account statement. As we said, it had nothing to do with the financial value, nor even the purchasing power of the items, just their symbolic value. He could understand why Julius Caesar needed to incur the cost of having Vercingetorix, the leader of the Gaul Rebellion, brought to Rome and paraded in chains, just so he could exhibit victory in the flesh. There is another dimension to the need to focus on actions and avoid words, the health eroding dependence on external recognition. People are cruel and unfair in the way they confer recognition, so it is best to stay out of that game. Stay robust to how others treat you. Nero, at some stage, befriended a scientist of legendary status, a giant for whom he had immense respect, although the fellow was about as prominent as one could get in his field, in the eyes of others. He spent his time focused on the status he had that week in the scientific community. He would become enraged at authors who did not cite him, or at some committee granting a medal he had never received to someone he judged inferior, that imposter. Nero learned that no matter how satisfied they could be with their work, these hotshots who depended on words were deprived of Tony's serenity. They remained fragile to the emotional toll from the compliments they did not get, the ones others got, and from what someone of lower intellect stole from them. So Nero promised himself to escape all of this with his small ritual, just in case he should fall prone to the hotshot's temptation. Nero's spoils from what he called the Fat Tony bet, after deducting the cost of a new car, a Mini, and a new $60 Swatch watch, amounted to a dizzyingly large amount sitting in a portfolio, the summary of which was mailed to him monthly from, of all places, a New Jersey address, with three other statements from overseas countries. Again, it is not the amount but the tangibility of his action that counted. The quantities could have been a tenth, even a hundredth as much, and the effect would remain the same. So he would cure himself of the game of recognition by opening the envelope containing the statement and then going on with his day, oblivious to the presence of those cruel and unfair users of words. But to follow ethics to their natural conclusion, Nero should have felt just as proud and satisfied had the envelope contained statements of losses. A man is honorable in proportion to the personal risks he takes for his opinion. In other words, the amount of downside he is exposed to. To sum him up, Nero believed in erudition, aesthetics, and risk-taking. Little else. As to the funds, to avoid the charity trap, Nero followed Fat Tony's rule of systematically making donations, but not to those who directly asked for gifts. And he never, never gave a penny to any charitable organization, with the possible exception of those in which not a single person earned a salary. Loneliness. A word on Nero's loneliness. For Nero, in the dark days before the economic crisis of 2008, it sometimes caused him pain to be alone with his ideas, wondering at times, typically Sunday nights, if there was something particularly wrong with him or if there was something wrong with the world. Lunch with Fat Tony was like drinking water after an episode of thirst. It brought immediate relief to realize that he was either not crazy or at least not alone in being crazy. Things out there did not make sense, and it was impossible to convey it to others, particularly people deemed intelligent. Consider that of the close to 1 million professionals employed in economic activities, whether in government from Cameroon to Washington, D.C., academia, media, banking, corporations, or doing their own private homework for economic and investment decisions, fewer than a handful saw it coming. Furthermore, an even smaller handful managed to foresee the full extent of the damage. And of those who saw it coming, not a single one realized that the crisis was a product of modernity. Nero could stand near the former World Trade Center site in downtown New York, across from the colossal buildings housing mostly banks and brokerage houses, with hundreds of people running around inside them, expending gigawatts of energy just moving and commuting from New Jersey, consuming millions of bagels with cream cheese, with insulin response inflaming their arteries, producing gigabytes of information just by talking and corresponding and writing articles. But noise it was. Wasted effort, cacophony, unaesthetic behavior, increased entropy, production of energy that causes a local warming up of the New York area ecozone, and a large-scale delusion of this thing called wealth that was bound to evaporate somehow. You could stack the books and they would constitute an entire mountain. Alas, to Nero, anything in them that deals with probability, statistics, or mathematical models is just air, in spite of evidence that and evidence this. And you learn more in a few lunches with Fat Tony than from the social science sections of the Harvard libraries, with close to 2 million books and research papers, for a total of 33 million hours of reading, close to 9,000 years worth of reading as a full-time activity. The only exception in that social science library is a few small sections in the cognitive science literature. Some of it works. Talk about a major sucker problem. What the non-predictor can predict. Fat Tony did not believe in predictions, and he made big bucks predicting that some people, the predictors, would go bust. Isn't that paradoxical? At conferences, Nero used to meet physicists from the Santa Fe Institute who believed in predictions and used fancy prediction models, while their business ventures based on predictions did not do that well. While Fat Tony, who did not believe in predictions, got rich from prediction. You can't predict in general, but you can predict that those who rely on predictions are taking more risks, will have some trouble, perhaps even go bust. Why? Someone who predicts will be fragile to prediction errors. An overconfident pilot will eventually crash the plane. And numerical prediction leads people to take more risks. Fat Tony is anti-fragile because he takes a mirror image of his fragile prey. Fat Tony's model is quite simple. He identifies fragilities, makes a bet on the collapse of the fragile unit, lectures Nero and trades insults with him about socio-cultural matters, reacting to Nero's jabs at New Jersey life, collects big after the collapse. Then he has lunch. Chapter 10, in which Professor Treefot refuses his own medicine, and we use Seneca and Stoicism as a backdoor to explain why everything anti-fragile has to have more upside than downside, and hence benefits from volatility, error, and stressors. The fundamental asymmetry. Seneca's upside and downside. How to survive advice. To lose nothing or gain nothing. What to do on your next shipwreck. A couple of millennia before Fat Tony, another child of the Italian peninsula solved the problem of antifragility. Except that, more intellectual than our horizontal friend, he spoke in a more distinguished prose. In addition, he was no less successful in the real world. Actually, he was vastly more successful in business than Fat Tony, and no less intellectual than Nero. The fellow was the Stoic philosopher Seneca, whom we mentioned earlier was the alleged lover of Nero's mother. He was not. And he solved the problem of antifragility, what connects the elements of the triad, using Stoic philosophy. Is this really serious? Lucius Annius Seneca was a philosopher who happened to be the wealthiest person in the Roman Empire, partly owing to his trading acumen, partly for having served as the tutor of the colorful Emperor Nero, the one who tried to whack his mother a few chapters ago. Seneca subscribed to, and was a prominent expositor of, the philosophical school of Stoicism, which advanced a certain indifference to fate. His work has seduced people like me and most of the friends to whom I introduced his books, because he speaks to us. He walked the walk, and he focused on the practical aspect of Stoicism, down to how to take a trip, how to handle oneself while committing suicide, which he was ordered to do, or mostly, how to handle adversity and poverty and, even more critically, wealth. Because Seneca was into practical decision-making, he has been described by academics as not theoretical or philosophical enough. Yet not a single one of his commentators detected in Seneca the ideas about asymmetry that are central to this book and to life, the key to robustness and antifragility. not one. My point is that wisdom in decision-making is vastly more important, not just practically, but philosophically, than knowledge. Other philosophers, when they did things, came to practice from theory. Aristotle, when he attempted to provide practical advice, and a few decades earlier, Plato, with his ideas of the state and advice to rulers, particularly the ruler of Syracuse, were either ineffectual or caused debacles. To become a successful philosopher king, it is much better to start as a king than as a philosopher, as illustrated in the following contemporary story. Modern members of the discipline of decision theory, alas, travel a one-way road from theory to practice. They characteristically gravitate to the most complicated but most inapplicable problems, calling the process doing science. There is an anecdote about one Professor Trifot. I am changing the name because the story might be apocryphal, though from what I have witnessed, it is very characteristic. He is one of the highly cited academics of the field of decision theory, wrote the main textbook, and helped develop something grand and useless called rational decision-making, loaded with grand and useless axioms and schmaxioms, grand and even more useless probabilities and schmobabilities. Trifot, then at Columbia University, was agonizing over the decision to accept an appointment at Harvard. Many people who talk about risk can spend their lives without encountering more difficult risk-taking than this type of decision. A colleague suggested he uses some of his very highly respected and grandly honored and decorated academic techniques with something like maximum expected utility, as, he told him, "You always write about this." Trifot angrily responded, "Come on, this is serious." By contrast, Seneca is nothing but "this is serious." He once survived a shipwreck in which other family members perished, and he wrote letters of practical and less practical advice to his friends. In the end, when he took his own life, he followed excellently and in a dignified way the principles he preached in his writings. So while the Harvard Economist is only read by people trying to write papers, who in turn read by people trying to write papers, and will be, hopefully, swallowed by the inexorable bullshit detector of history, Lucius Annius, known as Seneca the Younger, is still read by real people 2 millennia after his passing. Let us get into his message. Less downside from life. We start with the following conflict. We introduced Seneca as the wealthiest person in the Roman Empire. His fortune was 300 million denarii. For a sense of its equivalence, at about the same period in time, Judas got 30 denarii, the equivalent of a month's salary, to betray Jesus. Admittedly, it is certainly not very convincing to read denigrations of material wealth from a fellow writing the lines on one of his several hundred tables with ivory legs. The traditional understanding of Stoicism in the literature is of some indifference to fate, among other ideas of harmony with the cosmos that I will skip here. It is about continuously degrading the value of earthly possessions. When Zeno of Citium, the founder of the school of Stoicism, suffered a shipwreck, a lot of shipwrecks in ancient texts, he declared himself lucky to be unburdened so he could now do philosophy. And the key phrase reverberating in Seneca's oeuvre is nihil perditi, I lost nothing, after an adverse event. Stoicism makes you desire the challenge of a calamity, and Stoics look down on luxury. About a fellow who led a lavish life, Seneca wrote, "He is in debt, whether he borrowed from another person or from fortune." For those listeners who wonder about the difference between Buddhism and Stoicism, I have a simple answer. A Stoic is a Buddhist with attitude, one who says "fuck you" to fate. Stoicism, seen this way, becomes pure robustness, for the attainment of a state of immunity from one's external circumstances, good or bad, and an absence of fragility to decisions made by fate, is robustness. Random events won't affect us either way. We are too strong to lose, and not greedy to enjoy the upside. So we stay in the middle column of the triad. What we learn from reading Seneca directly, rather than through the commentators, is a different story. Seneca's version of that Stoicism is anti-fragility from fate. No downside from Lady Fortuna, plenty of upside. True, Seneca's aim on paper was philosophical, trying to stick to the Stoic tradition as described above. Stoicism was not supposed to be about gains and benefits, so on paper it was not at the level of anti-fragility, just about a sense of control over one's fate and the reduction of psychological fragility. But there is something that commentators have completely missed. If wealth is so much of a burden, while unnecessary, what's the point of having it? Why did Seneca keep it? As I said, concerning the psychologists who in Chapter 2 ignore post-traumatic growth but focus on post-traumatic harm, intellectuals have this thing against anti-fragility. For them, the world tends to stop at robustness. I don't know what it is, but they don't like it. This made them avoid considering that Seneca wanted the upside from fate, and there is nothing wrong with it. Let us first learn from the great master how he advocated the mitigation of downside, the standard message of the Stoics. Robustness, protection against harm from emotions, how to move away from the first column of the triad, that sort of thing. Second step, we will show how he truly proposed anti-fragility. And third step, we will generalize his trick into a general method of detection of anti-fragility in chapters 18 and 19. Stoicism's emotional robustification. Success brings an asymmetry. You now have a lot more to lose than to gain. You are hence fragile. Let us return to the story of Damocles' sword. There is no good news in store, just plenty of bad news in the pipeline. When you become rich, the pain of losing your fortune exceeds the emotional gain of getting additional wealth, so you start living under continuous emotional threat. A rich person becomes trapped by belongings that take control of him, degrading his sleep at night, raising the serum concentration of his stress hormones, diminishing his sense of humor, perhaps even causing hair to grow on the tip of his nose and similar ailments. Seneca fathomed that possessions make us worry about downside, thus acting as a punishment as we depend on them. All upside, no downside. Even more, dependence on circumstances, rather the emotions that arise from circumstances, induces a form of slavery. This asymmetry between the effects of good and bad, benefit and harm, had to be familiar to the ancients. I found an earlier exposition in Livy. Men feel the good less intensely than the bad. Segnius homines bona quam mala sentiunt, he wrote half a generation before Seneca. Ancients, mostly thanks to Seneca, stay way ahead of modern psychologists and Trifot-style decision theorists who have developed theories around the notion of risk or loss aversion. The ancients remain deeper, more practical, while transcending vulgar therapy. Let me rephrase it in modern terms. Take the situation in which you have a lot to lose and little to gain. If an additional quantity of wealth, say, 1,000 Phoenician shekels, would not benefit you, but you would feel great harm from the loss of an equivalent amount, you have an asymmetry. And it is not a good asymmetry. You are fragile. Seneca's practical method to counter such high fragility was to go through mental exercises to write off possessions, so when losses occurred, he would not feel the sting, a way to wrest one's freedom from circumstances. It is similar to buying an insurance contract against losses. For instance, Seneca often started his journeys with almost the same belongings he would have if he were shipwrecked, which included a blanket to sleep on the ground, as inns were sparse at the time, though I need to qualify, to set things in the context of the day, that he had accompanying him only one or two slaves. To show how eminently modern this is, I will next reveal how I've applied this brand of Stoicism to wrest back psychological control of the randomness of life. I have always hated employment and the associated dependence on someone else's arbitrary opinion, particularly when much of what's done inside large corporations violates my sense of ethics. So I have, accordingly, except for 8 years, been self-employed. But before that, for my last job, I wrote my resignation letter before starting the new position, locked it up in a drawer, and felt free while I was there. Likewise, when I was a trader, a profession rife with a high dose of randomness, with continuous psychological harm that drills deep into one's soul, I would go through the mental exercise of assuming every morning that the worst possible thing had actually happened. The rest of the day would be a bonus. Actually, the method of mentally adjusting to the worst had advantages way beyond the therapeutic. as it made me take a certain class of risks for which the worst case is clear and unambiguous, with limited and known downside. It is hard to stick to a good discipline of mental write-off when things are going well, yet that's when one needs the discipline the most. Moreover, once in a while, I travel, Seneca-style, in uncomfortable circumstances, though unlike him, I am not accompanied by one or two slaves. An intelligent life is all about such emotional positioning to eliminate the sting of harm, which, as we saw, is done by mentally writing off belongings so one does not feel any pain from losses. The volatility of the world no longer affects you negatively. The domestication of emotions. Seen this way, Stoicism is about the domestication, not necessarily the elimination, of emotions. It is not about turning humans into vegetables. My idea of the modern Stoic sage is someone who transforms fear into prudence, pain into information, mistakes into initiation, and desire into undertaking. Seneca proposes a complete training program to handle life and use emotions properly, thanks to small but effective tricks. One trick, for instance, that a Roman Stoic would use to separate anger from rightful action and avoid committing harm he would regret later, would be to wait at least a day before beating up a servant who committed a violation. We moderns might not see this as particularly righteous, but just compare it to the otherwise thoughtful Emperor Hadrian's act of stabbing a slave in the eye during an episode of uncontrolled anger. When Hadrian's anger abated and he felt the grip of remorse, the damage was irreversible. Seneca also provides us a catalog of social deeds. Invest in good actions. Things can be taken away from us, not good deeds and acts of virtue. How to become the master. So far, that story is well known, and we have learned to move from the left of the triad, fragile, to the center, robust. But Seneca went beyond. He said that wealth is the slave of the wise man and master of the fool. Thus he broke a bit with the purported Stoic habit. He kept the upside. In my opinion, if previous Stoics claimed to prefer poverty to wealth, we need to be suspicious of their attitude, as it may be just all talk. Since most were poor, they might have fit a narrative to the circumstances. We will see with the story of Thales of Miletus the notion of sour grapes, cognitive games to make yourself believe that the grapes that you can't reach taste sour. Seneca was all deeds, and we cannot ignore the fact that he kept the wealth. It is central that he showed his preference of wealth without harm from wealth to poverty. Seneca even outlined his strategy in De Beneficiis, explicitly calling it a cost-benefit analysis by using the word bookkeeping. The bookkeeping of benefits is simple. It is all expenditure. If anyone returns it, that is clear gain. If he does not return it, it is not lost. I gave it for the sake of giving. Moral bookkeeping, but bookkeeping nevertheless. So he played a trick on fate, kept the good and ditched the bad, cut the downside and kept the upside. Self-servingly, that is, by eliminating the harm from fate and unphilosophically keeping the upside. This cost-benefit analysis is not quite Stoicism in the way people understand the meaning of Stoicism. People who study Stoicism seem to want Seneca and other Stoics to think like those who study Stoicism. There is an upside-downside asymmetry. That's anti-fragility in its purest form. And for those who believe that Zeno, the founder of Stoicism, was completely against material wealth, I have some news. I accidentally found a mention of his activities in maritime financing, where he was an involved investor. Not exactly an activity for the anti-wealth utopist. The foundational asymmetry. Let us put together Seneca's asymmetry in a single rule. The concept I used earlier is more to lose from adversity. If you have more to lose than to benefit from events of fate, there is an asymmetry, and not a good one. And such asymmetry is universal. Let us see how it brings us to fragility. Consider the package in Chapter 1. It does not like to be shaken, and it hates the members of the disorder family. Hence, it is fragile. Very fragile, because it has absolutely nothing to gain, hence it is very asymmetric. The anti-fragile package has more to gain than to lose from being shaken. Simple test. If I have nothing to lose, then it is all gain, and I am anti-fragile. The entire graphic 1 in your PDF with triads across fields and domains can be explained in these terms. Everything. To see why asymmetric payoffs like volatility, just consider that if you have less to lose than to gain, more upside than downside, then you like volatility. It will, on balance, bring benefits, and you are also anti-fragile. So the job falling upon this author is to make the link between the four elements as follows with the foundational asymmetry. Fragility implies more to lose than to gain, equals more downside than upside, equals unfavorable asymmetry. And anti-fragility implies more to gain than to lose, equals more upside than downside, equals favorable asymmetry. You are anti-fragile for a source of volatility if potential gains exceed potential losses, and vice versa. Further, if you have more upside than downside, then you may be harmed by lack of volatility and stressors. Now, how do we put this idea, reduction of a downside, increase in upside, into practice? By the method of the barbell in the next chapter. Chapter 11. What to mix and not to mix. The barbell strategy in life and things as the transformation of anything from fragile to anti-fragile. Never marry the rock star. A precise protocol on how and with whom to cheat on one's husband. Introduction to barbell strategies. Transforming diplomats into writers, and vice versa. The barbell, or bimodal strategy, is a way to achieve anti-fragility and move to the right side of the triad. Monogamous birds put it into practice by cheating with a local rock star, and writers do better by having as a day job a sinecure devoid of writing activities. On the irreversibility of broken packages. The first step toward anti-fragility consists in first decreasing downside rather than increasing upside. That is, by lowering exposure to negative black swans and letting natural anti-fragility work by itself. Mitigating fragility is not an option, but a requirement. It may sound obvious, but the point seems to be missed. For fragility is very punishing, like a terminal disease. A package doesn't break under adverse conditions, then manage to fix itself when proper conditions are restored. Fragility has a ratchet-like property, the irreversibility of damage. What matters is the route taken, the order of events, not just the destination. What scientists call a path-dependent property. Path dependence can be illustrated as follows. Your experience in getting a kidney stone operation first and anesthesia later is different from having the procedures done in the opposite sequence. Or your enjoyment of a meal with coffee and dessert first and tomato soup last would not be the same as the inverse order. The consideration of path dependence makes our approach simple. It is easy to identify the fragile and put it in the left column of the triad, regardless of upside potential, since the broken will tend to stay permanently broken. This fragility that comes from path dependence is often ignored by businessmen who, trained in static thinking, tend to believe that generating profits is their principal mission, with survival and risk control something to perhaps consider. They miss the strong logical precedence of survival over success. To make profits and buy a BMW, it would be a good idea to, first, survive. Notions such as speed and growth, anything related to movement, are empty and meaningless when presented without accounting for fragility. Consider that someone driving 250 miles per hour in New York City is quite certain to never get anywhere. The effective speed will be exactly 0 miles per hour. While it is obvious that one needs to focus on the effective, not the nominal speed, something in the socio-political discourse masks such an elementary point. Under path dependence, one can no longer separate growth in the economy from risks of recession, financial returns from risks of terminal losses, and efficiency from danger of accident. The notion of efficiency becomes quite meaningless on its own. If a gambler has a risk of terminal blow-up, losing back everything, the potential returns of his strategy are totally inconsequential. A few years ago, a university fellow boasted to me that their endowment fund was earning 20% or so, not realizing that these returns were associated with fragilities that would easily turn into catastrophic losses. Sure enough, a bad year wiped out all these returns and endangered the university. In other words, if something is fragile, its risk of breaking makes anything you do to improve it or make it efficient inconsequential unless you first reduce that risk of breaking. As Publilius Cyrus wrote, nothing can be done both hastily and safely. Almost nothing. As to growth in GDP, gross domestic product, it can be obtained very easily by loading future generations with debt, and the future economy may collapse upon the need to repay such debt. GDP growth, like cholesterol, seems to be a Procrustean bed reduction that has been used to game systems. So just as, for a plane that has a high risk of crashing, the notion of speed is irrelevant, since we know it may not get to its destination, economic growth with fragilities is not to be called growth, something that has not yet been understood by governments. Indeed, growth was very modest, less than 1% per head, throughout the golden years surrounding the Industrial Revolution, the period that propelled Europe into domination. But as low as it was robust growth, unlike the current fool's race of states shooting for growth like teenage drivers infatuated with speed. Seneca's Barbell. This brings us to the solution in the form of a barbell. About all solutions to uncertainty are in the form of barbells. What do we mean by barbell? The barbell, a bar with weights on both ends that weightlifters use, is meant to illustrate the idea of a combination of extremes kept separate, with avoidance of the middle. In our context, it is not necessarily symmetric. It is just composed of two extremes, with nothing in the center. One can also call it, more technically, a bimodal strategy, as it has two distinct modes, rather than a single, central one. I initially used the image of the barbell to describe a dual attitude of playing it safe in some areas, robust to negative black swans, and taking a lot of small risks in others, open to positive black swans, hence achieving anti-fragility. That is, extreme risk aversion on one side and extreme risk loving on the other, rather than just the medium or the beastly moderate risk attitude that in fact is a sucker game, because medium risks can be subjected to huge measurement errors. But the barbell also results, because of its construction, in the reduction of downside risk, the elimination of the risk of ruin. Let us use an example from vulgar finance, where it is easiest to explain but misunderstood the most. If you put 90% of your funds in boring cash, assuming you are protected from inflation, or something called a numeraire repository of value, and 10% in very risky, maximally risky securities, you cannot possibly lose more than 10%, while you are exposed to massive upside. Someone with 100% in so-called medium risk securities has a risk of total ruin from the miscomputation of risks. This barbell technique remedies the problem that risks of rare events are incomputable and fragile to estimation error. Here, the financial barbell has a maximum known loss. For anti-fragility is the combination aggressiveness plus paranoia. Clip your downside, protect yourself from extreme harm, and let the upside, the positive black swans, take care of itself. We saw Seneca's asymmetry. More upside than downside can come simply from the reduction of extreme downside, emotional harm, rather than improving things in the middle. A barbell can be any dual strategy composed of extremes without the corruption of the middle. Somehow they all result in favorable asymmetries. Again, to see the difference between barbells and non-barbells, consider that restaurants present the main course, say, grass-fed minute steak cooked rare and salad, with Malbec wine, then, separately, after you are done with the meat, bring you the goat cheese cake with Muscat wine. Restaurants do not take your order, then cut the cake and the steak in small pieces and mix the whole thing together with those machines that produce a lot of noise. Activities in the middle are like such mashing. Recall Nero in Chapter 9 hanging around with janitors and scholars, rarely with middle brows. In risky matters, instead of having all members of the staff on an airplane be cautiously optimistic or something in the middle, I prefer the flight attendants to be maximally optimistic and the pilot to be maximally pessimistic, or better, paranoid. The Accountant and the Rock Star. Biological systems are replete with barbell strategies. Take the following mating approach, which we call the 90% accountant, 10% rock star. I'm just reporting, not condoning. Females in the animal kingdom, in some monogamous species, which include humans, tend to marry the equivalent of the accountant, or, even more colorless, the economist, someone stable who can provide, and once in a while they cheat with the aggressive alpha, the rock star, as part of a dual strategy. They limit their downside while using extra pair copulation to get the genetic upside, or some great fun, or both. Even the timing of the cheating seems non-random, as it corresponds to periods with high likelihood of pregnancy. We see evidence of such a strategy with the so-called monogamous birds. They enjoy cheating, with more than a tenth of the broods coming from males other than the putative father. The phenomenon is real, but the theories around it vary. Evolutionary theorists claim that females want both economic social stability and good genes for their children. Both cannot always be obtained from someone in the middle with all these virtues, though good gene providers, those alpha males aren't likely to be stable, and vice versa. Why not have the pie and eat it too? Stable life and good genes. But an alternative theory may be that they just want to have pleasure, or stable life and good fun. There is evidence of such a barbell strategy, but no clarity about the theory behind it. Evolutionary theorists enjoy narratives, but I prefer evidence. We are not sure if the strategy of extra pair copulation in the animal domain actually enhances fitness, so the barbell, accountant plus cheating, while it exists, might not be aiming at the improvement of the species. It can be just for fun, at low risk. Also recall from Chapter 2 that overcompensation, to work, requires some harm and stressors as tools of discovery. It means letting children play a little bit, not much more than a little bit, with fire and learn from injuries, for the sake of their own future safety. It also means letting people experience some, not too much, stress, to wake them up a bit. But at the same time, they need to be protected from high danger. Ignore small dangers, invest your energy in protecting them from consequential harm, and only consequential harm. This can visibly be translated into social policy, health care, and many more matters. One finds similar ideas in ancestral lore. It is explained in a Yiddish proverb that says, "Provide for the worst, the best can take care of itself." This may sound like a platitude, but it is not. Just observe how people tend to provide for the best and hope that the worst will take care of itself. We have ample evidence that people are averse to small losses, but not so much toward very large black swan risks, which they underestimate, since they tend to insure for small probable losses, but not large infrequent ones. Exactly backwards. Away from the golden middle. Now let us continue our exploration of barbells. There are so many fields in which the middle is no golden middle, and where the bimodal strategy, maximally safe plus maximally speculative, applies. Take literature, that most uncompromising, most speculative, most demanding, and riskiest of all careers. There is a tradition with French and other European literary writers to look for a sinecure, say, the anxiety-free profession of civil servant, with few intellectual demands and high job security, the kind of low-risk job that ceases to exist when you leave the office, then spend their spare time writing, free to write whatever they want, under their own standards. There is a shockingly small number of academics among French authors. American writers, on the other hand, tend to become members of the media or academics, which makes them prisoners of a system and corrupts their writing and, in the case of research academics, makes them live under continuous anxiety, pressures, and indeed, severe bastardization of the soul. Every line you write under someone else's standards, like prostitution, kills a corresponding segment deep inside. On the other hand, Sinecure Coombe Writing is a quite soothing model, next best to having financial independence, or perhaps even better than financial independence. For instance, the great French poets Paul Claudel and Saint-Jean Peirce and the novelist Stendhal were diplomats. A large segment of English writers were civil servants. Trollope was a post office worker. Kafka was employed by an insurance company. Best of all, Spinoza worked as a lens maker, which left his philosophy completely immune to any form of academic corruption. As a teenager, I thought that the natural way to have a real literary or philosophical career was to enter the lazy, pleasant, and undemanding profession of diplomat, like many members of my family. There was an Ottoman tradition of using Orthodox Christians as emissaries and ambassadors, even ministers of foreign affairs, which was retained by the states of the Levant. My grandfather and great-grandfather had been ministers of foreign affairs. Except that I worried about the wind turning against the Christian minority, and was proved right. But I became a traitor and did my writing on my own time and, as the listener can see, on my own terms. The barbell businessman-scholar situation was ideal. After 3 or 4 in the afternoon, when I left the office, my day job ceased to exist until the next day, and I was completely free to pursue what I found most valuable and interesting. When I tried to become an academic, I felt like a prisoner, forced to follow others' less rigorous, self-promotional programs. And professions can be serial. Something very safe, then something speculative. A friend of mine built himself a very secure profession as a book editor, in which he was known to be very good. Then, after a decade or so, he left completely for something speculative and highly risky. This is a true barbell in every sense of the word. He can fall back on his previous profession should the speculation fail, or fail to bring the expected satisfaction. This is what Seneca elected to do. He initially had a very active, adventurous life, followed by a philosophical withdrawal to write and meditate, rather than a middle combination of both. Many of the doers-turned-thinkers like Montaigne have done a serial barbell, pure action, then pure reflection. Or, if I have to work, I find it preferable and less painful to work intensely for very short hours than do nothing for the rest of the time, assuming doing nothing is really doing nothing, until I recover completely and look forward to a repetition, rather than being subjected to the tedium of Japanese-style low-intensity interminable office hours with sleep deprivation. Main course and dessert are separate. Indeed, Georges Simenon, one of the most prolific writers of the 20th century, only wrote 60 days a year, with 300 days spent doing nothing. He published more than 200 novels. The domestication of uncertainty. We will see many barbells in the rest of this book that share exactly the same asymmetry and somehow, when it comes to risk, produce the same type of protection and help in the harnessing of anti-fragility. They all look remarkably similar. Let us take a peek at a few domains. With personal risks, you can easily barbell yourself by removing the risks of ruin in any area. I am personally completely paranoid about certain risks, then very aggressive with others. The rules are no smoking, no sugar, particularly fructose, no motorcycles, no bicycles in town, or more generally outside a traffic-free area such as the Sahara Desert. No mixing with the Eastern European mafias, and no getting on a plane not flown by a professional pilot, unless there is a co-pilot. Outside of these, I can take all manner of professional and personal risks, particularly those in which there is no risk of terminal injury. In social policy, it consists in protecting the very weak and letting the strong do their job, rather than helping the middle class to consolidate its privileges, thus blocking evolution and bringing all manner of economic problems that tend to hurt the poor the most. Before the United Kingdom became a bureaucratic state, it was barbelled into adventurers, both economically and physically, and an aristocracy. The aristocracy didn't really have a major role except to help keep some sense of caution, while the adventurers roamed the planet in search of trading opportunities or stayed home and tinkered with machinery. Now the city of London is composed of bourgeois bohemian bonus earners. My writing approach is as follows. On the one hand, a literary essay that can be grasped by anyone, and on the other, technical papers, nothing in between, such as interviews with journalists or newspaper articles or op-ed pieces outside of the requirements of publishers. The listener may remember the exercise regimen of Chapter 2, which consists in going for the maximum weight one can lift, then nothing, compared to other alternatives that entail less intense but very long hours in the gym. This, supplemented with effortless long walks, constitutes an exercise barbell. More barbells. Do crazy things, break furniture once in a while, like the Greeks during the later stages of a drinking symposium, and stay rational in larger decisions. Trashy gossip magazines and classics or sophisticated works, never middlebrow stuff. Talk to either undergraduate students, cab drivers, and gardeners, or the highest caliber scholars, never to middling but career-conscious academics. If you dislike someone, leave him alone or eliminate him. Don't attack him verbally. In finance, I stood in 2008 for banks to be nationalized rather than bailed out, and other forms of speculation not entailing taxpayers left free. Nobody was getting my barbell idea. Some hated the libertarian aspect, others hated the nationalization part. Why? Because the halfway, here the regulation of both, doesn't work, as it can be gamed by a good lawyer. Hedge funds need to be unregulated and banks nationalized, as a barbell, rather than the horror we now have. So take for now that a barbell strategy with respect to randomness results in achieving anti-fragility thanks to the mitigation of fragility, the clipping of downside risks of harm, reduced pain from adverse events, while keeping the benefits of potential gains. To return to finance, the barbell does not need to be in the form of investment in inflation-protected cash and the rest in speculative securities. Anything that removes the risk of ruin will get us to such a barbell. The legendary investor Ray Dalio has a rule for someone making speculative bets. Make sure that the probability of the unacceptable, that is, the risk of ruin, is nil. Such a rule gets one straight to the barbell. Domain dependence again. People find insuring their house a necessity, not something to be judged against a financial strategy. But when it comes to their portfolios, because of the way things are framed in the press, they don't look at them in the same way. They think that my barbell idea is a strategy that needs to be examined for its potential return as an investment. That's not the point. The barbell is simply an idea of insurance of survival. It is a necessity, not an option. Most items on the right of the triad have a barbell component, necessary but not sufficient. So just as stoicism is the domestication, not the elimination, of emotions, so is the barbell a domestication, not the elimination, of uncertainty. Book 4. Optionality, Technology, and the Intelligence of Anti-Fragility. Now we get into innovation, the concept of options and optionality. How to enter the impenetrable and completely dominate it, conquer it. Do you really know where you are going? Summa Theologiae by St. Thomas Aquinas is the kind of book that no longer exists, the book as monument, a summa being the comprehensive treatment of a given discipline, while freeing it from the structure the authorities had given it before, the anti-textbook. In this case, its subject matter is theology, meaning everything philosophical, and it comments on every body of knowledge as it relates to his arguments, and it reflects, and largely directs, the thought of the Middle Ages. Quite a departure from the book with a simple closed-end subject matter. The erudite mind's denigration of anti-fragility is best seen in a sentence that dominates the Summa, being repeated in many places, one variant of which is as follows: an agent does not move except out of intention for an end. Agen autem non movet nisi ex intentione finis. In other words, agents are supposed to know where they are going, a teleological argument from telos, based on the end, that originates with Aristotle. Everyone, including the Stoics, but excluding the Skeptics, fell for such teleological arguments intellectually, but certainly not in action. Incidentally, it is not Aristotle whom Aquinas is quoting. He calls him the philosopher, but the Arab synthesizer of Aristotle's thinking, Ibn Rushd, also known as Averroes, whom Aquinas calls the commentator. And the commentator has caused a great deal of damage. For Western thought is vastly more Arabian than is recognized, while post-medieval Arabs have managed to escape medieval rationalism. This entire heritage of thinking, grounded in the sentence, an agent does not move except out of intention for an end, is where the most pervasive human error lies, compounded by two or more centuries of the illusion of unconditional scientific understanding. This error is also the most fragilizing one. The teleological fallacy. So let us call here the teleological fallacy the illusion that you know exactly where you are going, and that you knew exactly where you were going in the past, and that others have succeeded in the past by knowing where they were going. The rational flaneur is someone who, unlike a tourist, makes a decision at every step to revise his schedule so he can imbibe things based on new information, what Nero was trying to practice in his travels, often guided by his sense of smell. The flaneur is not a prisoner of a plan. Tourism, actual or figurative, is imbued with a teleological illusion. It assumes completeness of vision and gets one locked into a hard-to-revise program, while the flaneur continuously and, what is crucial, rationally, modifies his targets as he acquires information. Now, a warning. The opportunism of the flaneur is great in life and business, but not in personal life and matters that involve others. The opposite of opportunism in human relations is loyalty, a noble sentiment, but one that needs to be invested in the right places, that is, in human relations and moral commitments. The error of thinking you know exactly where you are going and assuming that you know today what your preferences will be tomorrow has an associated one. It is the illusion of thinking that others, too, know where they are going, and that they would tell you what they want if you just asked them. Never ask people what they want, or where they want to go, or where they think they should go, or worse, what they think they will desire tomorrow. The strength of the computer entrepreneur Steve Jobs was precisely in distrusting market research and focus groups, those based on asking people what they want, and following his own imagination. His modus was that people don't know what they want until you provide them with it. This ability to switch from a course of action is an option to change. Options and optionality, the character of the option, are the topic of Book 4. Optionality will take us many places, but at the core, an option is what makes you anti-fragile and allows you to benefit from the positive side of uncertainty without a corresponding serious harm from the negative side. America's principal asset. And it is optionality that makes things work and grow, but it takes a certain type of person for that. Many people keep deploring the low level of formal education in the United States, as defined by, say, math grades. Yet these fail to realize that the new comes from here and gets imitated elsewhere. And it is not thanks to universities, which obviously claim a lot more credit than their accomplishments warrant. Like Britain in the Industrial Revolution, America's asset is, simply, risk-taking and the use of optionality, this remarkable ability to engage in rational forms of trial and error with no comparative shame in failing, starting again, and repeating failure. In modern Japan, by contrast, shame comes with failure, which causes people to hide risks under the rug, financial or nuclear, making small benefits while sitting on dynamite. An attitude that strangely contrasts with their traditional respect for fallen heroes and the so-called nobility of failure. Book 4 will take this idea to its natural conclusion and will show evidence, ranging from medieval architecture to medicine, engineering, and innovation, that perhaps our greatest asset is the one we distrust the most, the built-in anti-fragility of certain risk-taking systems. Chapter 12. Thales versus Aristotle and the notion of optionality, which allows you not to know what's going on. Why it has been misunderstood owing to the conflation. How Aristotle missed the point. Optionality in private life. Conditions under which tinkering outperforms design. Rational Flaneur. Thales Sweet Grapes. Where we discussed the idea of doing instead of walking the great walk, the idea of a free option, can a philosopher be called nouveau riche? An anecdote appears in Aristotle's Politics concerning the pre-Socratic philosopher and mathematician Thales of Miletus. This story, barely covering half a page, expresses both anti-fragility and its denigration and introduces us to optionality. The remarkable aspect of this story is that Aristotle, arguably the most influential thinker of all time, got the central point of his own anecdote exactly backward. So did his followers, particularly after the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution. I am not saying this to denigrate the great Aristotle, but to show that intelligence makes you discount anti-fragility and ignore the power of optionality. Thales was a philosopher, a Greek-speaking Ionian of Phoenician stock from the coastal town of Miletus in Asia Minor, and like some philosophers, he enjoyed what he was doing. Miletus was a trading post and had the mercantile spirit usually attributed to Phoenician settlements. But Thales, as a philosopher, was characteristically impecunious. He got tired of his buddies with more transactional lives hinting at him that those who can, do, and others philosophize. He performed the following prowess. He put a down payment on the seasonal use of every olive press in the vicinity of Miletus and Chios, which he got at low rent. The harvest turned out to be extremely bountiful, and there was demand for olive presses, so he released the owners of olive presses on his own terms, building a substantial fortune in the process. Then he went back to philosophizing. What he collected was large, perhaps not enough to make him massively wealthy, but enough to make the point, to others, but also, I suspect, to himself, that he talked the talk and was truly above, not below, wealth. This kind of sum I've called in my vernacular, "f*** you money," a sum large enough to get most, if not all, of the advantages of wealth, the most important one being independence and the ability to only occupy your mind with matters that interest you, but not its side effects, such as having to attend a black-tie charity event and being forced to listen to a polite exposition of the details of a marble-rich house renovation. The worst side effect of wealth is the social associations it forces on its victims, as people with big houses tend to end up socializing with other people with big houses. Beyond a certain level of opulence and independence, gents tend to be less and less personable, and their conversation less and less interesting. The story of Thales has many morals, all of them linked to asymmetry and the construction of an anti-fragile payoff. The central one is related to the following account by Aristotle. But from his knowledge of astronomy, he had observed while it was still winter that there was going to be a large crop of olives. So for Aristotle, clearly, the stated reason was Thales' superior knowledge. Superior knowledge? Thales put himself in a position to take advantage of his lack of knowledge and the secret property of the asymmetry. The key to our message about this upside-downside asymmetry is that he did not need to understand too much the messages from the stars. Simply, he had a contract that is the archetype of what an asymmetry is, perhaps the only explicit asymmetry you can find in its purest form. It is an option, the right but not the obligation for the buyer, and, of course, the obligation but not the right for the other party called the seller. Thales had the right, but not the obligation, to use the olive presses in case there would be a surge in demand. The other party had the obligation, not the right. Thales paid a small price for that privilege, with a limited loss and large possible outcome. That was the very first option on record. The option is an agent of anti-fragility. Option and asymmetry. The olive press episode took place about 600 years before Seneca's writings on his tables with ivory legs and 300 years before Aristotle. The formula in chapter 10 was, anti-fragility equals more to gain than to lose, equals more upside than downside, equals asymmetry unfavorable, equals likes volatility. And if you make more when you are right than you are hurt when you are wrong, then you will benefit in the long run from volatility, and the reverse. You are only harmed if you repeatedly pay too much for the option. But in this case, Thales patently got a good deal, and we will see in the rest of Book 4 that we don't pay for the options given to us by nature and technological innovation. Financial options may be expensive because people know they are options and someone is selling them and charging a price, but most interesting